Mass shootings disappeared for a while in the early days of the COVID lockdown, but they returned as schools and businesses opened back up. For schools and organizations grappling with this, some have taken the approach of increasing security measures, putting metal detectors in place, or doing active shooter drills. But what if instead of increasing security, we could prevent mass violence in the first place? Our next guest spent years reporting on an approach that's shown some success with a tool known as behavioral threat assessments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more focus on how to prevent mass shootings? Do you see this kind of threat assessment going on in your school, in your community, maybe in your workplace? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Fullman is National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones. His new book is called Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we get into threat assessment, you say right off the bat, you're not writing a book about guns and gun laws in particular. Could you talk about why you didn't focus on guns and gun laws as part of the solution here?
Sure. Well, of course, we have to acknowledge that mass shootings inherently involve guns. But I have been investigating this issue for the past decade and done a lot of reporting as well on the political debates over gun violence and gun laws, investigated those topics. But for me, this project and the pursuit of this book was about really going beyond that to see what else we could do to try to solve this problem, because those debates that we have vigorously over and over again tend to go around in circles. And you know, the battle over gun laws is an important one. It's an essential issue to dealing with gun violence, of course. But I became convinced years ago that there had to be more we could do to solve this problem. And when I started learning about the method of behavioral threat assessment as an additional solution, I found it very interesting and potentially quite compelling. And that's what set me off on the path of writing this book.
And you've spent years talking to people, the pioneers of behavioral threat assessments, people putting it into practice around the country as well. Can you give us the basics? What is a behavioral threat assessment program?
So essentially, this is a method that seeks to intervene ahead of a person who is planning an attack like this. And that's an important thing to point out at the outset here. We have a big myth about mass shootings that these are, they're treated as impulsive crimes. Mm-hmm. You always hear the question, what made the guy snap afterwards, as if this is an impulsive act. But that's not true at all. The case evidence makes clear that in every case, these are people who are developing an idea for violence, are planning it, are taking steps to prepare, and are then carrying it out. And as a part of that, they are also giving off a range of behavioral warning signs. And that is the heart of this work. It's a collaborative model that brings in law enforcement and mental health expertise primarily to evaluate a person of concern, to look at a more holistic picture of their circumstances and behaviors, and identifies patterns within that to evaluate the level of danger. Is this a person who's thinking about and planning violence, and does this person have the means to carry out that violence? And in answering those questions through the protocols of this method, then a threat assessment team is able to develop a plan to intervene and to manage the situation with the goal of trying to divert the person away from this violent thinking and this violent planning onto a better path. Because these are often people who are having a lot of problems in their lives, right? A lot of mental and behavioral health issues.
Now, when a mass shooting actually does happen, we'll see it in the news. When a behavioral threat assessment works, it's probably going to be a success we don't hear about. You highlight, though, some of those success stories, including you touch on an example in Wisconsin where these methods may have prevented a mass shooting. Can you share a little of that story with us? And I understand you can't release very particular details.
Sure. Yes, there are quite a lot of these cases around the country in recent years where threat assessment teams have successfully gotten in the way of and constructively worked with individuals to prevent them from committing violent attacks. And it's a really interesting concept in the sense that the results are sort of proving a negative, because you're talking about a successful case is the absence of a violent outcome. It's the absence of evidence. So this isn't news. This doesn't make news stories because nothing happened in that sense. So there is a case from Wisconsin that I talk about early in the book in brief. And, you know, a lot of these are sensitive. So this was one where I can't share details of where it was or who it was. But it was a high school student who had been talking about the possibility of a shooting at his high school, referring it to it kind of obliquely, but kind of fixating on that over time. And this came to attention of authorities doing this work. It turned out the student also was carrying around a notebook with a list of his enemies, what's known in this field of work as the hit list, people that he said, quote, he wanted to eliminate. This is a common signal in a lot of threat cases, and in particularly with school shootings. He had also said to a friend, as the team started to gather more information around him by talking to his peers and his teachers, a friend reported that he had talked about something big, quote unquote, about to go down later in the week at a school assembly. So through these various indications, the team became sufficiently alarmed and moved to intervene and get him help to try to steer him away from this violent thinking.
Talking to Mark Fullman about his new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, can you talk about what this process looks like? Let's stay in the school setting a little bit. A school where the community has been trained in these kind of things, what kind of steps do they start to take when they first get those warning signals, like the ones you were just mentioning?
Sure. So the contours of that case I was describing are common. There are many school threat cases like this that have gone on. And I write in the book at length about a program that I was able to immerse in out in Oregon, in the city of Salem. The Salem-Keizer School District there was one of the early pioneers of this model in a school setting. They built a program after Columbine in 1999. There had been another very traumatic school shooting in Oregon the prior year in Springfield. So they were very focused on this problem. And the field of threat assessment had just begun to really develop a focus on school shootings specifically. It originates with some other forms of planned violence, assassination and celebrity stalking and workplace violence. But after Columbine, there was intensive focus on schools. And so I was able to spend a lot of time with the people who built the program in Oregon and had a lot of cases over the past two decades where they've been able to intervene with students like the one I was describing from Wisconsin, who were giving off these behavioral warning signs, indications that they may be thinking about bringing a gun to school and committing a shooting. And the way that they intervene foremost is to step in with constructive measures to try to help a kid in crisis. In Salem, they call it their wraparound strategy. They extend lots of close personal support. They try to create tighter connections with trusted teachers that a student may like, give them counseling, give them independent educational support, try to work with the family, which isn't always possible. There are tough family situations in a lot of these cases, and you may have parents in denial or hostile even to the idea that this is going on with their child. But by using this kind of broad range of constructive interventions, they're able to, in many cases, successfully help steer a troubled student onto a better course.
Another element that you talk about in the book is what some of the experts call leakage, a very common, apparently, for people who commit mass shootings to have told people about it in advance. What kind of training comes as part of this threat assessment to the community, whether that's a community of students or at a workplace or maybe even an online community?
Right. So that term leakage refers to one of the sort of areas or categories of behavioral warning signs known as threatening communications, the ways that perpetrators signal their intent through, and it takes various forms, comments to peers in their talk, but also in writings in many cases, in journals, and of course, in the digital media age, online, on social media. And signals like this are not in and of themselves predictive of anything. There's no one thing that tells you someone is planning a mass shooting. But where this becomes highly relevant is when a person is raising concern in people around them, causing anxiety and fear. And the need for public awareness of that combined with these kinds of behaviors is helpful to this field because it's more likely to be reported. So we just had a pretty traumatic example of this again last fall in Michigan, with the Oxford High School mass shooting. There were a number of peers of that perpetrator who were worried about things he had been posting on social media, but didn't speak out or weren't taken seriously. So I think to your question, it's about building better community awareness of what these things mean, and also having the community know that they can turn for help to a program like this.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Interesting topic. Really looking forward to reading the book. My question is, based on which study you read, somewhere between 30% and 70% of perpetrators of mass shootings have a history of domestic violence. So I'm curious what opportunities there are to sort of intervene there. And I guess for anybody who has experienced that or is experiencing that specifically, is there something that they can turn to possibly prevent a mass shooting?
Mike, thanks for the call. Mark?
It's a great question. I'm glad Mike raised that because the field has learned over time about a whole range of factors that feed into this problem. And domestic violence is one of them. It's significant. So when that comes up in a case, it's an important data point, an important signal. And it speaks to also the plans they can make to manage a case, to intervene. If there's a domestic violence issue going on, or a person has problems in that territory, that's going to inform how they're going to approach handling that person and trying to help that person. And in some cases, this does develop into more punitive response. Not every person is going to be responsive to constructive interventions, but many are. And there are many cases where it can be effective, including with that issue.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We're talking to Mark Fullman, National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones. His new book is Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about threat assessments being used to stop mass shootings, hopefully before they come to that point? What questions do you have about how they work? If you work in education or law enforcement, have you been through a training like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with journalist Mark Fullman about his new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. He looks at the growing interest in threat assessments, behavioral assessments that help prevent shootings, maybe help people reach out to the potential perpetrator and prevent it from happening in the first place. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, you write about kind of a contagion or copycat effect, often going back to the Columbine shooting you mentioned earlier. You have some ideas on how we in the media can talk about these shootings. You point to an example I want to listen to. This is New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern talking after a shooting at a mosque in Christchurch there in 2019.
He will face the full force of the law in New Zealand. The families of the fallen will have justice. He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist, he is a criminal, he is an extremist, but he will, when I speak, be nameless. And to others, I implore you, speak the names of those who were lost, rather than the name of the man who took them.
Mark, can you talk about the value of that approach?
Yes, that was a very compelling moment after that horrific event in New Zealand a few years ago. And it was hopeful because it showed progress in that case, in a high profile public official responding to a mass attack. The case research of this field and my own research as an investigative journalist into the problem of mass shootings has revealed an extensive trail of perpetrators who seek notoriety, who want media attention, sensational media attention. And so that presents, I think, a unique opportunity to make positive change with this problem too. The media doesn't cause anyone to commit a mass shooting. However, if people have that as a source of inspiration, it tends to exacerbate the problem in many cases, with what we also know as the so-called copycat problem that you mentioned, that primarily grew out of Columbine, but now extends to other high-profile attacks whose perpetrators that others identify with. And so I looked into this quite a lot several years ago and did some reporting on it for Mother Jones, and it's in the book as well. I arrived at an idea that I call strategic diminishment, because the flip side of this is also not tenable in my view. There's been a movement to completely black out the names and identities and images of shooters, but there's a strong public interest that the media has to serve to report on these attacks. I think the reasons why are obvious in terms of the impact, but also to combat misinformation. There are a number of examples of cases going back many years where people have been misidentified in the immediate aftermath as the perpetrator, and that has consequences. So the media has a role and a duty to report on these cases in the public interest. And what I mean by strategic diminishment is really striking the right balance to kind of shrink the frame around the perpetrator and only report what has meaning and value to understanding what happened and understanding this problem better. Beyond that, we look away. We don't focus excessively on the sensational or salacious details of the perpetrator. That used to be a much more common practice in the media. And the good news here is that this has changed a lot in recent years. I think the media understands better now that that's not good, that that can have bad effects. So we're not plastering their faces all over the front pages anymore. This is a good thing.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi. I guess basically I have a comment. You know, I've raised two kids, and they were raised around guns. And I grew up in a gun culture. I'm 55 years old. We took our guns to school for English speech, and didn't have any problems. I think we have to look at what has gone on from back then to now. You have social media, which has definitely been adding to it, and also both parents working. At one point, you had a parent home all the time while one person worked. So I think we have to look at how society is today and how it was, because we didn't have these problems before.
Tim, thanks for the call. Mark, a lot of the shootings we're talking about, of course, happened before there was social media.
That's true. I think what the caller is getting at is an interesting point in the sense of how it does point to kind of broader cultural questions we have about this problem, cultural and political questions. What is it about our society that has caused this to continue and to escalate in a number of ways? And I think the speed and reach of digital media is certainly part of that equation, as we were just discussing.
Sure.
In terms of prevention work, the practical approach to this is really about evaluating the specific circumstances and behaviors in any given case. So we live in the world we live in now, and that's really what the work is all about.
Thanks for that call. Mark, you mentioned a myth earlier about the, you know, impulsive snap decision to commit this kind of violence. That's not how it works, you say. Another myth you tackle is that this is mainly or entirely somehow a mental health problem, a mental illness problem.
That's right. And those two myths are very closely entwined. The notion that mental illness is the cause of all these attacks is fundamentally wrong. And that's the way we tend to talk about it in the general public and in the media, that mental illness is what caused someone to do this. But when you study the cases, it's just simply not true. Most of these cases do not involve perpetrators who have clinically diagnosable mental illness. Now, these are people who have a lot of mental health problems and life problems, behavioral problems. They're going through tough stuff and they are dealing with it in an unhealthy way. But that's not the same thing as what we take that to mean in a lay sense. These are not people who are crazy, who are hallucinating, who are hearing voices telling them to do this. That fundamentally misunderstands these cases. Even in cases where there is significant mental illness, that's rarely a primary cause. So the question then is, what is it that is driving people to do this, and how are they acting? And by trying to blame it all on mental illness, it just sort of lets us all off the hook to make it this other, but it's counterproductive and it's wrong and it's damaging. It's stigmatizing. There are many people who do have those diseases who would never turn violent. There's lots of scientific research showing that mental illness is not predictive of violence.
In just our last couple of minutes, some of the things you're saying sound really hopeful, actually. If this isn't an completely unpredictable snap decision, if this isn't the result of some unfixable mental condition in perpetrators, that means, and I think this is the main point of your book, that these things are preventable.
That's right. And for me, the process of researching and writing this book over a number of years, it really drew me to that core theme, that really this is about demystifying this problem in a number of ways. We tend to talk about these as senseless tragedies that we can't explain. But for me, this became about making sense of them. And we can do that. That's what this field does. And that's how this model approaches it. So it's not going to solve the problem in its entirety, but it is a potentially very powerful additional tool we can use to prevent these attacks from happening. And that inherently is very hopeful and very optimistic. And I saw that too in the leaders and pioneers of this field, that to dedicate themselves to this work, inherently they have to have this kind of optimistic and constructive outlook on the problem. And so it's very uplifting to see all these cases that I write about in the book where they've succeeded. Again, they're not news because nothing bad happened, but when you go behind the curtain and enter this world of work, it is very hopeful for doing more to reduce this problem in our country.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Mark Fullman. He's National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones Magazine. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called Trigger Points: Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. If you have worked at an institution that has done this kind of behavioral threat assessment, still love to hear from you. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org.